Okay, so good evening, good afternoon, and good morning to everyone who's joining us today from around the world. My name is Elena Stavrevska. I'm a research officer at the LSE Center for Women, Peace and Security, which is hosting today's panel discussion as part of our 3-week-long Visions of Feminist Peace program. I have the honor of chairing today's discussion. The Visions of Feminist Peace program, in case you haven't been following it for the past week and a half, is organized as part of the Feminist International Law of Peace and Security, or FILPS for short, project, which is funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. Today's panel is followed by an artistic performance tonight with the Citizens of the World Choir performing via live stream, reflecting on the concept of feminist peace. You can register for that through the website of the center. Then just to give a little bit of a teaser of what's happening next week, on Monday we have a panel hosted by our colleagues at WILF titled How Feminist Peace Can Transform Power, People and Our Planet. And then on Tuesday, we have the last panel, although not the last happening related to the program, which is hosted by us, and it is titled International and Intergovernmental Institutions, What Mandate for a Gender-Just Peace? Today's panel, we named Strategies and Practices for Gender-Just Peace Building, and I have the distinct honor of welcoming three incredible peace activists and peace builders, whose tireless work and advocacy has been shaping and expanding our imaginary of peace and feminist peace, in particular at national, regional, and international level. And I'm very, very excited that the three of you, each of whom has done incredible work, will be also in conversation today, joining us from different contexts. So today we have with us, and this will be the order in which we will be speaking as well, Helen Kezin-Moha, who is a feminist peace activist and a woman human rights defender from Nigeria. And she's currently the executive director at the Women's International Peace Center in Uganda. She's joining us today from Kampala. Then second will be Visakha. Visakha Dharmadasa is a Sri Lankan peace activist who is the chair of the Association of War-Affected Women, which she founded in 2000. And previously, she had founded the Parents of Servicemen Missing in Action, also in Sri Lanka. Today, she's joining us from Kandy in Sri Lanka. Last but not least, someone who's coming from the context that I know very well, because it's my home region, Lepa Mlajenović, who is a lesbian feminist anti-war activist born in socialist Yugoslavia. She's a feminist counselor working with women with trauma of male violence and trauma of anti-lesbianism, among the many other things each of the three of them are. I'll keep it brief, but I'm sure our audience is aware of your very rich biographies. Now, when thinking about peace, I often go back to poetry. Well, go back is a strong word there, but I often think of poetry and I'm inspired by it. And today, when I was thinking about this panel, especially because the three of you come and work at the intersections of quite different groups of people affected by violence and different types of violence as well, I thought of segments of the work of two poets whose work and lived experiences have been defined by intersections of gender, race, bodily ability, sexuality, and age. The first one is Paul Guest, who says, among other things, there is no need to make peace with a world that has no peace. And then the second is a feminist icon, one could say, Audre Lorde, who says, who has written that when we speak, we are afraid our words will not be heard nor welcomed, but when we are silent, we're still afraid. So it is better to speak, remembering we were never meant to survive. And in that context, I think the work of all three of you kind of connects that you haven't made peace with a world that has no peace, and that each of you has spoken and is speaking out in very, in different contexts, but pretty loudly, and we hear that. Now, for today, today's discussion, we outlined a few questions meant mainly as prompts, which relate to the ways of understanding everyday practices of feminist peace. What feminist methods and strategies are there for peace in your experience? What strategies have feminists pursued in creating spaces of peace, especially, but not exclusively, in places of conflict and physical violence? But also, one can argue, in institutions that discuss conflict and violence as well. Then how do feminists reimagine and rearticulate peaceful geographies? Each of these questions can obviously be discussed for hours, if not days. If peace is both personal and political, which we as feminists believe to be, how do we articulate peace as plural, complex, intersectional, and multi-sided? And finally, what role does the collective play in envisioning and pursuing a feminist peace? Not an easy task, but I'm sure all three of you will provide us a lot of food for thought. But before I invite Helen to take the floor, a couple of technical notes. The videos and the sounds, the audios are turned off for everyone in the audience. But please do ask your questions in the chat, and I will bring them up with the panelists as we go on. We are recording this event, and we're also currently live on Facebook. So greetings to those of you who are joining us through Facebook. The order will be such that Helen will speak first, then Visakha, then Lepa, for each of them for about 8 to 10 minutes. And then hopefully we'll have a discussion and a conversation among the three together with the audience as well. Those of you who are joining on Facebook, you can also ask your questions there. They will be brought to our attention here. Finally, if you are tweeting or using social media related to today's event, I can encourage you to use the hashtag #FeministPeace, which you're not obliged to do, but that is something that we have been using so far. Right, without further ado, I've already taken up too much time. Helen, the floor is all yours.
Thank you very much, Elena. It's so good to connect and see you online. I miss the physical contact this time. So I will start with our understanding of everyday practice of feminist peace. And just to say that feminism itself is a complex, you know, concept that when we are applying it to peace building, for us it's still a learning process. You know, we are interrogating and challenging ourselves on a daily basis on how we apply feminist peace, you know, in the work that we do. But most importantly, you know, 20 years after UN Security Council Resolution 1325, I think it's a good time to reflect on everyday practice of peace building, you know, from a feminist perspective. 20 years, yes, you know, we should do that. You know, the practice cannot continue the same way it has been. So at the Women's International Peace Center, we understand feminist peace as that which enables us to interrogate the power structures embedded in peace building at different levels, particularly institutional level, that we must understand this kind of structural violence in that exists in our context, in our communities, in our everyday peace building, for us to be able to understand how best, you know, we can build peace. Feminist peace for us is about challenging and addressing the root causes of conflict, which in most cases are usually not done. And many times the root causes of conflict is coming from marginalization, violation of the rights of citizens, violation of rights of citizens to basic human services, social services. Those are some of the root causes. Thinking about how people of different ethnic groups are being marginalized within governance structures. People of different sexual orientation are being marginalized, you know, in everyday living, are some of the issues that, you know, we fail to challenge when we are talking about peace building. But finally, it's also being able to challenge the militarized nature of peace building, and profiling the voices of women and girls and their post-conflict needs. You know, so many times we have peace processes that are not dealing you know, with this, and we're saying that feminist peace should allow us, you know, to encompass all these different practices. So in the work that we do at the Peace Center, how do we then apply feminist peace? So one of the things we do through our research and documentation is to make sure that we collect information on the impact of conflict on women and girls. But not just collecting information, at the same time doing that, providing the needed psychological and mental well-being for war-affected communities. You can't do research, collect information without addressing how war has impacted on communities. And one of the greatest impacts of war on communities is trauma. And most of the peace and post-conflict processes never deal with trauma. And so we have circles of people being traumatized and re-traumatized. Imagine a woman who is raped during conflict and the man who raped her is walking around freely and even making, you know, continuous signs at her. But her, she has lost her bodily integrity. She has lost her, you know, her pride and what it, and then the, no one is paying attention to that. So if we must do research, we must address how the war has impacted on women. And for us, we advocate that trauma is one of them and mental health. We also promote women being at the table of peace building. Because when women are at the table, they reflect what women and girls need. They reflect issues of sexual violence. They reflect economic empowerment. They reflect issues of land rights. You know, they highlight the emerging issues of conflict, climate change, violent extremism. You know, those are the things women bring to the table. They hardly go to the table to negotiate power sharing. They don't do that. But what we are also doing is to begin to create the table for women. Why are we creating tables? We have failed to get women to the table. So if you're not a president of a country, if you're not leading a political opposition group or you're a rebel group, you don't get to the table. So we create tables for women. And how are we doing that? We are constituting women mediators network at the grassroots level. We all know that women are always the first responders when there's violence, when there's, you know, crisis. They take up responsibility to support everyone in the community. So we are training women to collect early warning signs of conflict, engage with local communities and local leaders to address those issues. We have seen from our experience in Uganda that once women are provided with the needed tools, they are able to demand accountability for leaders to address human security issues that are affecting them. The advantage of this is that once you have those core group of women, when crisis comes up, as we have had in COVID, they immediately become the first people to respond, providing information to communities and also including information about prevention and highlighting what women and girls need in crisis situation. They put themselves. The second point, Elena, I want to look at is the closing, the issues of space, the shrinking space, you know, how we're navigating all of this. There are two ways I want to look at it, you know, but I would like to say that 20 years after Women Peace and, you know, the 1325, the space for women to engage in peace building is shrinking. It's shrinking at global level at the UN. It's shrinking at different regional levels, economic communities, regional bodies. It's shrinking at national level. I know the, you know, various times that the NGO Working Group on Women, Peace and Security at the UN has to continuously push to have women speak at the Security Council. Do we need to push to speak at the Security, at the UN Security Council? It should be automatic. I mean, you wouldn't say, people wouldn't say at this point that they don't know that war impacts on women and girls differently. They know it. They would not say that they don't know that the bodies of women and young women are being used as sites, you know, of conflict. Women are continuously being raped, you know, and violated during conflict. So why shouldn't their voices be heard, you know, in those conversations? We the other way that they are also shrinking our voices is not, we don't have money to travel. Yes, it's even good now that we are all speaking on webinar, but do we have the space to even pay for us to be on the webinar. And even where we have to travel, some of us cannot afford. Others are denied visas because of the countries where they live, because of the statutes which they hold, they are not able to engage in these processes. So, you know, should we continue like that? No, we shouldn't. 20 years after? No. I think that after 20 years and we are doing 25 years of 1325 and we are still like this, then the world is really not taking seriously the issues of women and girls who are affected by conflict. And what strategies have women used? In some of these spaces, you know, I've talked about the advocacy space, but at the peace building table, yes, women have really, you know, tried to get into those spaces. They've navigated those spaces and they've used different strategies. We know the women of Liberia who locked the men in that room until they signed an agreement. We know about the women of Somalia who had to form a cis clan. So women have used different strategies, you know, which includes being aggressive, you know, and demanding accountability. Women have negotiated. They've used shuttle diplomacy. They've tried to use all manner of strategies just to get into that space, just for their voices to be heard. Women have prayed. They've held night vigils. They have demonstrated against human rights violation. They've done so many things, and they continue to do that. So I think, Elena, to close, is that women have been able to work collectively. So let us not forget that the feminist principle of collective organizing that has helped women peace builders to be able to challenge, to get into those spaces, is the sisterhood that has helped us, you know, to keep together. That is what has made us to be able to hold each other's hands and demand for our voices to be heard in those spaces. And I think that if you ask me for sustainable peace, feminist approaches would just be the way, you know, that we can go. And I will stop there so that my colleagues can also speak. Thank you so much, Elaine.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Helen. And let me just point to the tote bag behind Lepa, which says sisterhood is powerful. Which connects really well to the last point you made, Helen. Thank you very much. Visakha, about 10 minutes or so?
Thank you very much. And really inspired by Helen's very powerful voice and also confident. I have been also thinking, like, what is feminist peace? What's different from the peace that we normally encounter? You know, coming from a country which had a 30-year-long war, even before they call uprising, they don't call it a war. There was in 1971, then 88, 89, which Sunila was also a part, and then a 30-year-long war, and very recently, the most recently, the Easter Sunday bombing. Peace, sometimes in my country, is not a good word. Sometimes it's venerated. But the issue, especially, I really do agree with Helen, in all the conflicts around the world, whether it is for land, whether it is for resources, but the underlying thing is discriminating. We see that the root causes for conflict is discrimination. Who else understands better discrimination than women? Because we are discriminated at every possible level, everywhere. It's not only the global south, but it is at the global north as well. You do see it, that women are discriminated. So we do understand that discrimination is one major root cause for conflicts. The other thing is dignity, the human dignity, because the Sri Lankan conflict, especially the Northeast war, was fought for dignity. And our call was always that whatever solution count to be made has to be, the overarching principle has to be dignity, the human dignity. And again, we as women, we do understand very well when we speak about dignity, a human dignity of a human being. And another one very important aspect of peace building, it's inclusiveness. And that's exactly where feminist peace is all about. We are for inclusion. We don't want to exclude anyone, no, whether it's race, whether it's creed, caste, color, language, or anything. We as women, we do want to include. And I believe in any peace process, not only to achieve peace, but most importantly, to sustain peace. Inclusivity is one of the cornerstone of sustainable peace. That's one thing what I see that we have to have. And the other thing is the trustworthiness. Being very closely involved in the Sri Lankan process or any other, the trust is a key for parties to come together. Even if they have to speak about any other things, initially they have to have some sort of trust between themselves. And who else is better in creating that trust? I always bring a very, very, local metaphor here, like the mother at home always come in between maybe the father and the other children, maybe among the siblings, to build that trust and bring them together. So again, the trust and equality. So when you hear all these words, who speaks about these words? Equality, trust, inclusiveness, it's all in our vocabulary. We speak about it. So who else is better to build peace and sustain peace? Helen also spoke about creating spaces. Women are very creative. We say, if the table is not enough, create the table in such a way that we can include everybody. This is exactly the way that I vision, or the feminist vision for peace building. You create the table because you need to get that person in. You don't exclude just because there is not no enough room, but you create it. And we are creators. Women are creators. We are very creative in doing things. So bring that aspect to the table, because it's extremely important to have a creative table. Think out of the box, because each context is very different from others. So you have to be there and know about it. And also Helen spoke about mediators. Yes, women are very good mediators because of the fact that we listen. We always listen. We have the patience to listen. You have to listen first to understand the difficulties of all sides. And we get that training as a girl at home. I always make myself to think, peace building is not rocket science. It's what we do day in and day out, at home, at our community, with our children, in the school, everywhere. And why can't we bring that creativity to these very difficult and complex issues? Why cannot we bring it? Why cannot we think creatively? Because it's extremely important. For us, life is very important. another metaphor I use is for a family, for a husband, it's the boundary which is very important, the fence of a house. But for the woman, it is the lives, the safety of her family is more important than that boundary. So this is why we say that women do need to be at the table, because it's extremely important for us to make this world a better place, not only for us, but for all. I'll stop at that and wait for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Visakha. I like that we already have a common thread in your two interventions, changing the vocabulary, among other things. May I just encourage everyone who is who has joined us either via Zoom or via Facebook to feel free to share any questions they might have or any comments in the chat, either on Zoom or on Facebook, so we can plug that in after Lepa's intervention. Lepa, last but not least, looking forward to hearing your thoughts.
Great. First, I want to say I'm so happy to be together with my sisters from Asia and Africa. And also I'm waving to everybody else who I can't see. Well, my vision and practice of feminist peace comes from my experience of the anti-war movement in Belgrade that started in 91 until 99. And just to remind maybe somebody that in that war, there were more than 135,000 killed and about 2 million displaced around the world, and many thousands of women. And we have started a feminist anti-war group, Women in Black Against War. And I have this also my activist shirt from Women in Black that says Peace Coalition. But what did we learn from the from the feminist peace activity movement? First of all, we learned that we have worked so much. Like Women in Black used to stay stand. We had vigils every week for 1 hour in black, in silence. We made hundreds of public statements. We published thousands of copies of books, but we didn't stop the war. Anti-war movement didn't stop the war. Not nearly affected the decisions of the war. So that's one thing that was very important for us to understand. But also, on the other hand, we have seen that we have created, we meaning feminist peace activists, a small civil society that in fact seeing how that we needed, that we wanted inside of our feminist peace movement to create a different world and toward feminist peace, even though we did not use that word. And the main phenomena, how to say, that we were researching every day was women's solidarity, international women's solidarity in so many different ways. And also it really meant also from to connect to both of you. One is learning to listen the other, the way the other hears herself. How do I hear this difference from me in the way that she hears herself? So that's really a wisdom, and it can be learned. So second thing is that I'm a feminist counselor, and I worked for 10 years with women raped in war. So what did we learn from women raped in war? First, we learned that men like, in their words, what they said, they say why they're in a war front, they say because we like shooting and fucking. That's exactly what they said. In fact, you know, killing and raping, first of all, it goes together. Second, that's something that attracts some men to go to the war zone. And then we feminists realized in the very beginning, because I was working with women surviving male violence even before the war, that practically male violence against women and war violence is a continuum, and that the emotional patterns of the perpetrators around me before the war and those on the war front are very similar. And therefore, we feminists realized very early that war is around us and inside us. And that is a structural patriarchy which we also contribute each one of us. So then we started very early to make workshops of experience to try to identify how do we contribute to militarism, to fascism on the everyday life. So that was very important. Past one toward the feminist. The second one we learned from women raped in war is first that after the news about women raped in war in August 92 became a news around the world, many feminist lawyers and feminist researchers took up this thing for the first time, and that was really incredible. So there was lots of things happening around this issue. And one of the results was that in the International Criminal Court for Former Yugoslavia and ICC International Criminal Court, there are articles which feminists have created, lobbied, and put there. So that's completely a new issue. Also to say that Patricia Sellers, who was on one of these seminars, was a feminist who entered into the ICTY, International Court for Former Yugoslavia, and brought, you know, feminism with herself inside such a huge institution. So it was crucial for women who came to testify that there was a feminist there. And the outcome is that first time in the history, there were first men who were convicted for rape in war. And we were in the beginning counting them, but maybe now it's more than 150 of these men. Some of them went to prison already back in their places. Some of them are still in prison, but I want to connect to what Helen said. But this did not bring joy to women, not particularly who were raped. The fact that they are so we learned that criminal justice really doesn't increase the well-being of women who are raped. It is of course important, there is no doubt about it, but we had to decide to work particularly on women's trauma, that's what, you know, and mental health, what Helen has just said. And also in that time, you know, we also were connected to the feminists who in Guatemala, who worked with women who survived their wars. This is another war. And they have launched this term, healing is justice. So since I'm a counselor and I work with emotions for 30 years, this for me is really the starting point. And that's the platform, one of the many platforms for feminists. That healing is justice. We can't wait until all the fascism finishes and all the bad news. We need to learn how to live a happy life now with all the bad news and wars and fascism around. And one of the other issues that we were also, worked a lot collectively in many countries, like Helen said, you know, feminists are now taking up this theme, because in the beginning when we started in 90, it wasn't the issue. So feminists, so we also discovered the term feminist ethics of care. Feminist ethics of care. What is it? It's really balancing the care toward the others and care for ourselves. Because in the patriarchal structure, women are supposed to take care of the others, as Risaka said. So that's very important, of course. That's precious. But we are women are not allowed to take care of ourselves, because then we are selfish, etc. But the feminist ethics of care says we need to rebalance the care for the others and care for ourselves. And therefore, that for women really means that we have to make a decision to take care of ourselves, which I sometimes like to say that we have to work toward unconditional friendship with ourselves. You know, that's the basis, because women are really always had these backward ideas about themselves. So another thing which I want to say is that learning, we had lots of different women in our anti-war movement, And my one question is, what did we learn from the lesbian feminist movement? And first of all, we learned that heterosexuality is at core of patriarchy, which very often is forgotten. Heterosexuality is institution and it's compulsory, as some of the theoreticians says, it's like compulsory institution, heterosexuality, which really means also that women, that not only that we are oppressed as women, but that we are directed emotionally and sexually toward men who belong to the category of oppressors. So that really makes it complicated how to liberate women from the discrimination, as Vishaka said. And the second thing that we learned from the lesbian feminist movement is, first of all, the lesbian feminists are not only women who are erotically and emotionally attracted to women, but and I'm one of them, but that we call sometimes ourselves women identified women. What does that mean? Among other things, it really means that some of us have had a long process of deconstructing, interiorized male authority in ourselves that has been inflicted by patriarchy for men, for all women, you know, that we have inside ourselves a male authority who says, you're not good enough, you have to do this, you know, who is watching and judging us on a daily level. So some of us feminist lesbians who work a lot in group and in workshops to deconstruct this and to replace it with some female authorities, but it's not just symbolically replacing, you know, female face by male face, but really getting rid of this hierarchy so that our own authority inside ourselves are in the level of equality, and that we are friendly conversation with our own authorities in ourselves. And I really conclude with this. I think that this in itself is disobedience to civilization, if I may cite Adrian Rijku, who said this. It's really disobedient. And I would say that one of the starting points for the feminist peace, apart from solidarity, which is crucial from the beginning to the end, is that we need to learn to be disobedient to male authorities, and that meaning a logic of militarism and abuse of power. So I'll just stop here.
Thank you. Lepa, there's a question in the chat. Who did you cite? Can you repeat the name, please?
Adrian Rich.
Oh, Adrian Rich. Okay, thank you. Thank you, all three. You have raised so many questions, more than we can possibly cover today, but that's always a good problem to have. I've noticed several different threads through the three interventions: reimagining the table, reimagining the vocabulary, reimagining care, challenging hierarchies within self and others, and outside, inside and outside. But I think the main issue probably, or the main common thread, is reimagining peace, because and there's a question about liberal peace in the chat. But what we see now, I found it striking when Vishaka said peace sometimes is not a good word where I come from, which reminds me to some of the conversations I've had with indigenous women in Colombia who say that peace as a word was introduced by the colonizers. So what kind of violence is then also contained in this idea of particularly liberal peace, which boils down to managing conflict, really, and managing certain types of conflict only. But anyways, I will not dwell too much on with my own questions, because we have quite a few questions in the chat. If we do have time, I would want you to intervene on some of my thoughts as well. But let me start with Cheryl Velasquez's question, who says, how can those of us who are in the US support women around the world? I'm a social worker and don't have much power, which I think, I don't know whether this will be related to, but you could potentially relate it to the second question, which comes from Abhishek Sharma, who asks, why is peace building, especially in the global South, complex, where the liberal framework is found to be by large extent redundant? and how can we integrate intersectionality in our approach to peace building? The reason why I'm asking the two questions together is because we can think obviously of intersectionality in a much broader global world, but also in a very localized world context. So whichever way you wanna, if you wanna tackle the questions, I leave it to you. And then we'll go with the second round of questions. Whoever wants to go first can go first. Should we go in the same order as we started the first round, and then in the second round we'll go in the other order?
Yeah, that's fine. You know, that's very interesting. And in terms of how you could support, I mean, people support in different ways. It could just be about speaking at wherever you are. It could be about understanding the different context where people are working. It could be about writing about what people are doing. It could also be about joining campaigns and advocacy. I mean, we've received support globally, you know, from different people. What is needed is huge. It could even be enabling someone to change their thinking, their attitude, you know, in terms of how they are perceiving peace building, but also speaking out on the violations, you know, that people are experiencing as a result of conflict. It could also be calling and naming, you know, those countries who are producing weapons. You know, these are powerful countries, name and shame them, call them to account. You know, so there are different ways and different things you can do, you know, to support the work that is happening. The other question about how
to integrate intersectionality.
Mm-hmm. You know, for me, you know, when I think about, you know, that is that we need to understand how structural violence, you know, how the institutions that we have, you know, around us have been conceptualized, you know, from a colonial point of practice and view. So we have institutions and practices that we have copied from the so-called developed world. We have policies and laws that we have copied from the so-called developed world that doesn't suit our context. You know, so the challenge is coming from the way that we have tried to build and what we have called development in itself, that we need to challenge what works for us as people in the context where we are. You know, that we need to stop copying and pasting practices, policies, laws, and try to develop our own indigenous ways of doing things. Then that brings me to our own understanding of what constitutes conflict. And what sites do conflict happen? And conflict happens in every day. It happens at your personal space, community space. I mean, you know, everywhere. Understanding those different spaces and the kind of conflict that happens then enables you to take care of the intersectionality in it, because there are different ways. And the challenge that we are having is that we cannot deal with one aspect of violence and leave the other. Until we begin to recognize those different sites where violence is happening, being able to connect them and address them, we might not be able to make a lot of progress in terms of building peace. And I think that's a challenge we have, that we women are discriminated, we are marginalized, inequality is existing, even in the so-called developed world. I mean, people are experiencing domestic violence, you know. So how do we deal with violence within the home, within the workspace, within the public space, you know, where we are having people call names and make signs, women are raped on the road and the rest of it, that we must address those different spaces and, you know, be able to see how we then also have a holistic approach, you know, where we are talking about issues of, you know, peace building, you know, and that we cannot talk about peace building in isolation, that it has a huge, you know, a lot of connection to social, economic, and political issues that were, you know, spheres and what happens in those spaces. You know, let me keep quiet, because I see there are so many other questions that have been fired at me, so that Lepa and Visakha cannot say something.
Never keep quiet, but for now let's go to Visakha and then to Lepa, and then I'll come back to you with two questions that are directly asking you something. Visakha.
Yes, thank you. For you, Elena, the word peace is definitely not Western. We don't take it as Western, because the fact that I think it's a Sanskrit word, shanti, So, I mean, it is there in mythology, and you know, whether it's a Hindu or a Buddhist or it come from this East, we do have it within us. We speak more about inner peace, which is very important to make outer peace. So that's there, it's within us. So it's not an alien thing for us. And also about the question from the US, I think the recognition, what is extremely important is for women peace builders, is the recognition that women do build peace at the grassroots, in their communities, day in and day out. Though they are not on the tables and not invited and ignored, but they are there and they do build peace. Especially, I mean, look at the COVID pandemic. Who was the first respondent and who really even stitched the masks, went, called the people, used their smartphones, got the food to the people, got the medicine, and also shared the health advices. So women are there in a crisis situation and they do need the recognition. So for our sister from the US, yes, we do need the recognition. I think that's the biggest that anyone can do for us. And also about, I think I don't want to go much into Abhishek's question because Helen already did justice. So I'll stop at that. And if there's any other question, I would like to come in. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Visakha. Lepa?
And I will go on recognition, what Visakha said, because that's really crucial. And that's what we also learned in the anti-war movement, that in fact, this solidarity from other women meant that there are some women who by their own will are interested to know how are we. And that was crucial, you know, that's the recognition, because they ask us or they come to us and they say, how are you? They want to know and they listen, and then we are not alone. And it's all around the world. I'm always talking from the point of view of a counselor, and from a point of starting point is emotion. So that's really crucial. So I'm thankful for the social worker from USA asking that question, because also in my experience is that we had so many fantastic different kinds of solidarity in these 10 years of wartime in my region, from the letters. You know, letters sometimes is enough. Hello, how are you? I don't know you, but I want to know how are you, or something like that. Or we even had sometimes some women sending us chocolate and coffee, which we didn't have at that time. So it was really like, wow, somebody is thinking of us, that we can have some good time also in the wartime. So there are really many different kinds of solidarity. So, but the my question is crucial. Thank you. And about intersectionality, I also want to look from the point of view of the emotions, because that's my profession. Because intersectionality, from one part, of course, means that some categories of people and women have different power. That's the point. We need to recognize this different hierarchy of power of different groups. But also, women have, because they're in a different context, they have completely different experiences. And we don't know what the other women feel or how does she live her life if she's in some completely other context. Even if she is in my street, like I have Roma people in my street, you know, my neighbor have no clue what's the vision of the world of this completely different, discriminated, you know, group, because they have different colors and they are so hated in our society. So they don't know how they live. They don't even want to know, nor they ever ask, how are you and what's your vision? Or even less, what do you need? So I'm looking at from the vision of the feminist peace, the intersectionality, if we want to look from the point of view of emotions, it's really crucial to understand that we want to know each other, because then it's much easier to collaborate and work together. And also, somebody said the other time in one of these webinars, we want to collaborate between different movements. That's also intersectionality, because that's how we can make some changes.
Thank you, Lepa. And I know that earlier we spoke that you have some pictures you want to share, speaking of connecting different movements from around the world.
Oh, yes.
Do you want to use the...
Yeah, that's I like to have some visuals.
So let's have a look at that, and then we'll return to
questions. So that's really 8 photos, and I will explain you this. Wait a minute. This is the first one. And that's from Women in Black Against War. Just to give you some impression, how did we look like? These are my comrades in 94. And we were very, very feminist, anti-fascist, anti-militarist group. And this is another picture also from the Women in Black. We used to have every year Women's Solidarity Against War International Encounter. And that year, the women from Bosnia and Herzegovina were still in war, and they couldn't come to our meeting because they were in wartime. And we were in Serbia at that time to be the meeting. Mm-hmm. And we were singing Bosnian songs to sort of send them a message we think of them. Also, there is another image of sisterhood that we were promoting and solidarity on everyday level. So this is the one. And this is one image more recently. It's about very important for us because the Serbian power have done a genocide in Srebrenica, and then the Belgrade feminist Women in Black are every year making remembrance of that, which is very difficult in this country because it's very nationalist environment. And and this is the last one from Women in Black. It's very important for us that every time we say that anti-fascism is our choice, and that's what it's written here. And I want for the end of these photos to give you a few other examples from Latin America, because I have said that women have to take care of ourselves. And this is one from Mexico that says, we are taking care of ourselves as friends, and we can't really trust police, which we have seen in the last year very well. And there is this image that says, defend joy, organize anger. I think it's very important also because I'm insisting that we take our emotions seriously. We, in a feminist piece, need to take our emotions seriously. And this is the last one for the photo. It says, our revenge is being happy. We want to be happy, including the fact that there is a war and fascist and war news around us. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Lepa. Now I'll go to Helen with two questions that are specifically about something you mentioned. One is from, before I do that, Angela Rodriguez, I see that your question is also related to intersectionality, so I hope that the responses did justice to your question as well. I'm not ignoring it. I just think that we might have covered it in the interventions for the other question. So question to Helen from Nadia Osakov. You said the space for women in the peace processes is shrinking despite the increasing awareness of the importance of their role. How did you come to this conclusion, and who is it to blame for this? And then a second question to you from Mayel Muller. You mentioned that you work with women mediator networks on the track 3 or grassroots level, and that you're creating space rather than trying to get to the table at the top level of track 1 negotiations. Do you see a way in which women can ensure to be active peacemakers, not only on the track 3 level, but also track 2 or track 1 in the future?
Yeah, thank you very much for all the questions. In terms of statistics, The UN Women, you can also go to their website, has been tracking women's participation in negotiations and in peace building. And in the past few years, they found that women's participation in negotiation, in negotiating delegations has not improved in the recent years. In 2018, for example, out of 6 active UN-led or co-led processes, women were included in 14 out of 19 delegations. Global data trends also show little progress. Between 1992 and 2018, women constituted 18% of negotiations, 3% of mediators, and only 4% of signatories in major peace processes, you know, tracked by the Council on Foreign Relations. So we have all these statistics and people have done the research. So we are not saying it because we are living it. So while we are living and experiencing it, you know, some other people are also collecting data to be able to show the evidence. And it's so interesting because when we go speaking, people ask us, but where is your evidence? You know, so we acknowledge and really, you know, thank UN Women for tracking and providing us with that data to be able to back up what we are saying, you know, but we also experience it in our daily lives that we are not being involved in these processes. So if you visit UN Women website, you will get a lot of those information. I hope that helps. And why is it so? It is so because peace has also been conceptualized from a militarized perspective. So we bring you to the table if you were at the war front. We don't bring you to the table when you did not fight. But you cannot take away the fact that women instigate wars. Women challenge their husbands and sons to go to war. Women are the ones who take over when war is taking place. They take responsibility for taking care of the children. Women also fight wars, you know. So, I mean, not bringing them to the table is also a disadvantage. So because we look at it from that perspective, we then don't see a reason why we should bring women who we are not at the war front. The other is that in majority of the cases, people are negotiating with leaders, military leaders. How many women are military leaders? How many women are heads of state? Just look around you globally. How many women are leading countries? So if we are bringing women to the table, if those are the ones negotiating the peace, then you don't find women, a lot of women at the table. So that is the reason. Why are women not at the table? Of course, those are structural issues. Inequalities exist continuously. So even if you're educated, because of the political systems within countries, women are unable to be president. Because the political space is violent, is fraudulent, is I don't know what to use to describe it. It's not attractive to women. And political practices have deliberately made the space, you know, in a way that women are not attracted to it. So can we make leadership spaces more attractive to women? Can we make political participation more attractive to women so that we have women in leadership positions and then they can be in those spaces? In terms of how can we move women from track one, you know, from track two and three to track one, is the same thing I'm talking about. Track one deals with the UN, heads of state. You know, you have to be a prime minister, a minister of something before you get to the formal table. How many women are prime ministers? You know, so the only thing we can do is exactly what I discussed before. You need multiple layers of intervention. Can we get girls to go to school? You know, if they need the qualification to be there, can we make the space conducive for women to participate? We know in my own context, people do campaigns at midnight when women are taking care of their children. You're not going to leave your baby to go and do campaign at night. How can we make the practice of decision making and getting into decision making more favorable to women? Even when affirmative action has been given to women, we're still not able to fill the space. Because one, when my family is poor, they would rather I marry and bring in them some money. How do we challenge social practices, norms that prevent girls, you know, from getting into those spaces? So it's a lot of work that we have to do. But let me just quickly, you know, talk a bit about intersectionality when we're talking about peace building as well. It's important for us to note that women are affected by conflict based on where they live, their educational level, their ethnicity, their sexuality. You know, so depending on your education, your economic status, that and the kind of human security that exists before the war determines how war impacts on you. So in terms of response, we need to then recognize that women are not a homogeneous group, but in most of the responses and peace building agreements, we are clustered as women, and then we are clustered as women affected by war. Some of us were raped, some of us were traumatized. Those are different impacts that require different responses. So the issue of intersectionality then becomes something that we need to incorporate in our responses. I hope I answered the questions, Elena.
More than. Thank you so much. And I mean, you saw all three of us nodding. I'm sure if we could see the other, if we could see the participants, they were also nodding along. And indeed, it's not just a question of women as a monolith. It's also which women can be by the table, can run for office, can be in these different spaces that you're talking about, and which women have been affected in what way. Thank you for that intervention. I have a question from Facebook. From those joining us through Facebook, from Sharmini Rampersaud. I'm really sorry if I'm mispronouncing someone's last name. I'm trying my best, but anyways, the question is, does populism threaten women, peace, and security as an agenda? And I think, I mean, I'll take the liberty of interpreting this a bit broadly, so not just the resolutions, not just the national action plans, but the policy and the discourse and the activism that happens around women, peace, and security. So what is your view on how the rise of populism, right-wing populism especially, probably, I'm guessing, around the world affects the agenda? Lepa, shall we start with you this time?
Well, first I want to just say one sentence to continue on what Helen has said. You know, enormous money has been done for women peace activists in this region after the war, after the 1325 has been launched. So to empower women activists to enter into the further peace negotiation, because the war is not finished in this region. There are still conflicts. And really, our after 10 years, even 15 years of this attempt, really, there is nothing achieved. So, I mean, the achievement is, again, the same thing. Women have learned a lot. We have empowered women who were in this process, but there is no women in the peace discussion in this region yet at all. So I'm really, it's really discouraging. It just says we need to keep on doing it. And about the populism, it's really for me connected to the neoliberal capitalism, you know, because you know, what are the values today? You know, the values is who has more money, and therefore especially I'm talking about this part of Europe, you know, who has more money or who is more appealing from this neoliberal point of view to the people, and also, you know, talking all these different things that people understand, they're voted. It's really sad. So, of course, there is just to say that many different rights, women's rights that we have worked for and achieved are now in danger. I don't want to, it's very well known. It's really a sad story.
Thank you. And thank you for also highlighting how global economic structures and powers also play a role. As I think Helen mentioned before, we cannot, or actually I think all of you mentioned in different ways, that we cannot just do peace building. It's also political, it's also economic, it's also social. It's multiple levels. Visakha, would you like to reflect on that question as well?
Yes, especially, Lepa, thanks for bringing the economic aspect. And I think the bottom line is that the world is not a peaceful place, especially because of economies of the global powers, because the economy lies on the arm manufacturing. I mean, without really mentioning this, it's there's no use of speaking about peace building. Until such time that we find different ways of livelihood to those who manufacture arms. I'm speaking about big companies. We will have wars because, you know, it's their living and they're very powerful. They need to live. So they need to have a war for them to live. I think that's, having said that, I must also say the pushback. You know, we have achieved because of 1325, CEDAW, everything. We have come a long way, but then we also see a pushback. But the pushback is very subtle. It's not very visible, but it's subtle pushback is there. And thank you, Helen, also for bringing that statistics. Yes, we know that Luz Mendez was there in Guatemalan peace process, Sabin Bona. But now you don't hear those words. The names. We don't hear that women are there on negotiation tables. I mean, look at Yemen, Afghanistan, Sudan. We really don't hear women playing that crucial role. Before, we do know that Senator Mobina Jaffer was a special envoy of Canada to Sudan. But now you don't even hear about special envoys. And really about UN, I mean, a lot of rhetoric at the UN level. They speak a lot about women, but you really don't see the action. And I think it's time for us to say that please do walk the talk, because lots of talk, but very little walking. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Helen, did you want to talk about populism, or should I go with the next question? Hold on. Unmute. Wait, there we go.
Yeah, I'm okay, I'm fine. Thank you. Yeah. It's interesting, you know, though, because I think one of the things we need to reflect on is how countries are always jumping, you know, on policies, on, you know, frameworks without really, you know, looking into how it is being implemented. So we have a number of all the policies in African countries. We don't lack policies. We have everything, but when it comes to implementation, we don't get to put resources into them. But also the fact that increasingly the nature of conflict is changing. So previously we have conflicts between countries. Now we are having conflicts within countries and of non-state actors. So all the issues around violence, extremisms, and all those, they are the ones that are dominating the debates and taking away, in a way, of course, when you talk about issues of women, peace, and security, it's like, can we first deal with these other issues that are threatening our securities at country level? You know, when we finish, then we shall come to the issues of women, peace, and security. But women are being they're being violated, they're being raped, they're the ones who are being impacted, you know, by some of these conflicts. Look at what is happening in northern Nigeria, Boko Haram, you know, crossing across, you know, Cameroon and everything, and people are being terrorized, and yet we are using military way to try to curb those. So at that point, no one is thinking about issues of discrimination or marginalization. We want to put some money, you know, to provide military equipment and so on and so forth. So that dominant notion and dominant narrative of what is urgent and what conflict is looking at now is even making it difficult for us to talk about the women, peace, and security agenda. So you're right, it impacts on it. It's affecting us. And so we are continuously pushing to look at violent extremism. How is it impacting on women? What are the impacts? You know, it's as if, and I think it's deliberate, it's as if a lot of the leaders do not want to pay attention to the women, peace, and security agenda because they think there's a bigger agenda. And our issues are really not it. How do we get all these rebels and extremist groups to be in place? What kind of negotiations? So you find them going to discuss without even having any woman on the table. Meanwhile, women are also impacted. So yes, it's affecting the women, peace, and security agenda because those are the dominant voices, you know. So our voices are not so dominant. We are not in those positions. And a lot of women who are in those positions of power also need to speak the language of men, you know, otherwise they will be seen to be weak, you know. So yes, it does. And I think that we just need to continuously, you know, speak about it, call for accountability, you know, and see how far we can push the boundaries. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you all for answering that question. And I, as you were speaking, especially about the temporality of when the issue of feminist peace, well, feminist peace is a stretch here, but even women, peace and security, when is the time for that? It's always later. As Cynthia Enloe very nicely says, later is a patriarchal time zone. So indeed, it is a continuous effort. Okay, so the next question is from Caitlin Ryan. I hope also you're following the chat, because there's a lot of gratitude for all your wonderful remarks here on Twitter, on Facebook. We'll summarize that at some point. But now to the question of Caitlin. She's asking if any of the panelists have insights on what types of economic barriers women might face that limit their ability to engage in peace building, and how these barriers can be challenged. I think each of you kind of touched on this, but how can they be challenged is the also key question here. Visakha, would you like to go first this time?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it is a big issue. The economic independence of women is a very big issue, I think, throughout the globe. And I don't think the economy of status of a woman is a barrier for her to build peace. Really, that's not the case. But in general, economic independence for women is an issue. But where peace building is concerned, it's not the women's economy, it's the global economy and the trends of global economy which impacts not necessarily only women, but all of us, especially because of the fact that people have become very money-minded. They have forgotten values, especially that's what we see in Sri Lanka. The values are eroding from the systems people do. I mean, it's not that people don't go to the temples or churches, but exactly the values which we were brought up as children, I'm 63 years, brought up, is eroding. So I think that's exactly one of the biggest issues, which, because you can have everything. They say that you can, if your money is gone, nothing is gone, but if your health is gone, something is gone, but if your morale is gone, everything is gone. So I think that's a big challenge that we face, not only as women, but as populations. And the economic thing is, of course, because of the fact that globally, weapon industry is really controlling many things. And that's exactly hurting the women peace builders, and they are put in danger, but not their economical status. Because whatever the economical status you are in, you could always, and you are always, building peace at your community level. So thank you.
Thank you, that's a very hopeful message. Lepa?
I want to give a totally different, you know, from my point of view, from emotions, you know. I'm working with women who survive sexual violence. The data says that every fifth woman has survived. I mean, this is around, not even in the war zone, but in Europe, you know, and other countries. Every fifth woman has survived a difficult trauma of rape. If we, in the countries where there is the so-called early marriages, that means that from 60 to 80% of women have survived rape in the early life, that's a rape trauma. We cannot think that these women will take any job, even if they're offered, even if they're given, even if they say, okay, go and work. I mean, I work with women, so we all know. There is a work for you to work in this shop. She can't do it because she starts, but then she has another triggers because some man comes in to buy bread, but she, you know, that he reminds her all this and that. So we need to work on trauma on women. We need to take emotions seriously. There is no way we can make all the different programs for economical development of women, but unless they can be ready psychologically, you know, emotionally to take up this work, we can't even get there. That's really important too. I'm really stressing that on every issue of feminist peace, we need to take emotion seriously. There is no other way. Because our brain cannot function. That's already many new researches on neurobiology of emotion that tells us, you know, first we need to be well emotionally in order that our rational brain can function and that we can think and make decisions and, you know, behave the way we want.
Thank you, Lepa. Helen, would you like to jump in here?
Yeah, thank you, Lepa, because I strongly believe that you cannot, you know, change or force women into post-conflict reconstruction and development processes when you have not dealt with the trauma. You're just wasting your time. Because at the point, they really don't see any sense in it. So restoring the trauma, dealing with the psychosocial problems will be the first step to enable them to engage in any form of empowerment. But I will just look at it again from another angle. We are acknowledging that yes, women are the grassroots level, they are the first responders, but no one is given enough resources for these women to do the work. The percentage of money going to women's organizations globally is below 5%, or it's about 6%. You know, so that important work that women's groups are doing to ensure economic empowerment, address sexual violence, deal with issues of trauma and mental health, is not being supported. There's not enough money to do that work. So if we want to deal with economic empowerment, we need to invest in girls and women's education, girls and women's mental health, issues around making sure women are in political processes and making elections peaceful to enable women's participation. So it's a lot of things, but it requires investment. But like Lepa said, even if you invested all the money, if the woman is not psychologically ready to engage, nothing really changes. So I just want to re-emphasize that we must deal with the traumas of women in conflict situation if we want anything to change. And it's that's a feminist point of view. Yeah, thank you, Elena.
Thank you. And actually, this brings me back to something that Lepa said in the initial intervention, that criminal justice is not well-being and healing is justice. Yeah. But the next question I have is about criminal justice. It's from Claire Wilmot. She says, in your work, do you think there is a role for criminal justice in building feminist peace? How do you think about creating consequences or accountability for violence against women that can disrupt structures of violence rather than reproducing them through incarceration or other harshly punitive criminal justice responses?
I just wanted to say, of course, yes, 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 yes. And I just also wanted just to repeat, you know, it was incredible what feminist lawyers have done after the many news on rape and war in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I really want to say that has changed a lot. Since I'm looking from the emotional point of view, I say that does not bring happiness to women, but it must be. And, you know, we need new feminist lawyers to do new laws everywhere, you know, nonstop. Thank you.
And for those of you who might have missed our Tuesday panel on precisely this topic, there will be a recording of that as well as this on the website of the center soon. So stay tuned for that. Who wants to answer this question next? Helen or Visaka?
Yeah, it's interesting because what we are seeing is, I mentioned before, the changing nature of conflict is also making it complicated, to be able to draw the line between crimes, you know, and war. So we find out that, you know, those pockets of things that are happening within the communities sometimes qualify as war, at another time they qualify as crime. But it's also because of the dominant narratives and definitions of what constitutes war, and then what constitutes crime, and then what constitutes peace. You know, so again, we have to take it back. Now, for us to be able to do this, we need to interrogate the power structures of how institutions and practices of mainstream peace building define all of these terms, and the way that it is then being applied both in law and in everyday practice of peace building. From my experience, you know, a lot of women that I've interfaced with, women we have interviewed, for them, justice is peace. You know, you can't rape me and think that I have peace because I've gone to the hospital, but the man who raped me, no one has ever called him to account. He's there lottering around. I will be peaceful when I find justice. You know, when I know that the person who caused me has accounted for it. You know, so for feminist peace, justice is also an important component that we can't just go around talking about peace without providing justice for the crimes that have been committed, you know, against civilians, against women, and against communities. So I think it's a good one. And of course, LEPA has already shared a lot on that. So I will allow Visakha to conclude.
Very briefly, yes, no justice, no peace. I mean, that's the bottom line. But having said that, also, why are we looking at transitional justice processes? Because of the fact that in times of war, armed conflicts and repression, sometimes you cannot bring everybody to the courts. So you have to, I mean, other than the ones who are directly involved in murder and all rape, all grave crimes. So we have to find ways and means of moving forward. But of course, justice is the cornerstone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have a very quick question for Helen, and then we'll wrap up. I think that will be. So this one is also came through Facebook from Numa Keita. She's asking if your engagement at grassroots level include women ex-combatants, women in disability, and the widowed. She says, in her master's research, I found that women from such background are normally not represented or consulted in building feminist peace building in post-conflict societies. And do you see this as the case and how it can be overcome, or how can we fill this gap? Sorry, I rushed a little bit through that, but I'm mindful of time.
And I think that as feminists, we are always conscious, you know, not to just speak about women without identifying the different categories. Sometimes when you go to communities, you find that some of the women ex-combatants, because of the label, you know, of being ex-combatants, you know, communities also discriminate against them and they hide their identities. So you really need to study the situation and bring them on board. Yeah, but yes, we do come across them. We do come across people who have been adopted, and then they come back. They have children who are also discriminated, and they are all struggling to get into integrate into the communities. So what we do is to specifically, when we are engaging, to be able to research first and find out who is on ground, and be able to map out the different categories of women. Tell you the truth, a woman will never come up to you the first time you go to a community and say, you know, I was raped. You know, I'm an ex-combatant. They wouldn't do that. But as you continue to engage with them, you're able to identify those. It's a conscious effort, and it's a political strategy for feminists to pay attention to those different groups of women. Because if you don't do that, it's like you go to a community and ask them to call women. They hardly will call you an old woman, because they think that she's old, that she doesn't have anything to add. They wouldn't call you a young woman. So you need to make that effort and say, but where are the young women? But where are these people? Don't you have these people? You know. So we've seen them and we engage them in a way that we can. But let me go back again to what I say. Many of them are so traumatized that whatever you're doing has no meaning. So you need to first address the traumas that they experience for them to see themselves to be part of the development process. The reason why many people will not find them is because of stigma, discrimination, name calling, you know, People call them names. They don't want to be seen as aggressive. And also, you know, in some cultures, women are not supposed to be aggressive. So you don't want to be seen to be the one who was a fighter. You don't want to also own up and say you were raped. Some women who were raped never said anything because they didn't want to lose their marriages. So there are a lot of factors, you know, that makes it impossible for these women to be visible.
It's raining, so.
So you have to make attempt to seek out for them and then ensure that they're included in those processes. Otherwise, your methodology also becomes skewed like the patriarchy ones that just say they are all women without paying attention to the different groupings. Yeah, I hope, Elena, that answers the question.
I hope so too. Thank you, Helen.
There's
one more question, and in 30 seconds or less. Let's do it a minute. But it's a hopeful question. That's why I want to ask it, so that we kind of, I think being hopeful, well, I don't think Paulo Freire teaches us that being hopeful is political, and we need hopefulness and to act on our hope. So I don't know if Madeline Church, who asked this question, meant it in a hopeful way, but I'm going to ask it that way anyway. If women had control of the global funds spent on arms and security, what would we spend it on? So one or two sentences. I know this could go on for days.
Shall I go in?
Yes, please.
I did answer also that question. I mean, feed the people, build houses, and education for all. I mean, that's it. And also climate. Take care of your environment, plant trees. There's lots and lots of things you can do without really fighting wars. Thank you. And I'm going to leave because I have to travel a long distance. So thank you ever so much for all. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Visakha. Safe travels. Thank you for joining us.
Bye.
Helen, do you want to go next?
Yeah. So, just to add to what Visakha was saying, if women get all this money, yes, then we make sure that everyone has access to health services, people are economically empowered. That's what I would do if I get that money. I'll make sure everyone is in school. I will make sure that everyone has access to water, you know, food, employment, because those are the basic things that will enable the economy to grow anyway. And I don't think that when you hand over such money to women, they are going to mismanage it in a way. So providing social services, the basic needs that people need, you know, and ensuring that the economy is working. I think that's what women will do with the money. Yeah, Lepa.
Thank you, Helen.
I will, of course, add what I'm insisting on the whole day. And that is definitely part of the money has to go to emotional literacy, meaning that all women and men, all people have to learn basic about emotions, because emotional construction is completely patriarchal, and we are repeating war systems in our daily life even when there is no war. So it's crucial that we learn about our emotions and that we make collective ways how to heal women who have been traumatized by war and violence.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the insights, for everything that you do, for joining us today, for selflessly sharing all your knowledge and experience with all of us. There's so much more to be said, and there's so much more to be learned from you. But today we'll end it here on the note of sisterhood and the note of how can we better spend the money that is currently spent on arms and security. Let me just remind everyone to please join us tonight at 8 p.m. UK time or British summer time for the choir performance of the Citizens of the World choir, and also the two panels next week, which should be hopefully just as inspiring. We expect them to be just as inspiring as the one today. Thank you very much for your questions, for your encouragement for the panelists, and we hope to see you throughout the rest of our program as well, of Visions for Feminist Peace.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Ciao.